More than that. So let's get started. So today I was going to do a bit of a dive into deep learning. It's everywhere and it's coming for us. And I wanted to try and get a handle on some of these papers that were talking about deep learning and classifying lung cancer last month. What I thought I'd just do is a little summary for, I did this for my benefit. I'm sure people know more than I do about this. Some of you do. But basically, artificial intelligence, we've all heard about that. Then there's machine learning as part of that. And then part of that is so-called deep learning. And data science overlaps that, as shown in this Venn diagram. So deep learning is a branch of machine learning. It's based on artificial neural networks. And these networks are based on how neurons fire in the brain. So these networks can learn complex representations of data by discovering hierarchical patterns and features. I can't see my, there we go, and features in the data. But unlike machine learning, deep learning models can comprehend unstructured data and make general observations without something called manual feature extraction. And there's all sorts of different deep learning architectures, including convolution neural networks, CNNs. And CNNs are specifically for image and video recognition tasks. They're able to automatically learn features from the images, do image classification, object detection, and image segmentation. This is just a diagram of artificial neural networks. So there's a first layer that receives input. It then passes on to these hidden layers, and all sorts of magic happens in here, which is a bit of the black box thing. And things are weighted, can also be weighted by the data scientist. And then finally, you get your output layer. Then there's two types of data sets you'll come across. There's supervised machine learning, which is where these artificial neural networks learn to make predictions or classify data based on labeled data sets. And that's what we'll be talking about mostly today. And then there's unsupervised machine learning, where it's you just put kind of agnostic data in. It learns to discover the patterns or cluster the data set. And some of the papers talk about that as well. And it sees the hidden patterns or relationships within the database. So clustering is one of the things that that's referring to. I'm not going into any math here, but just to mention that some of the ways that you evaluate the model performance is something called the F-score. It's a machine learning metric which measures model performance, with zero being no good and one being perfect. It provides accurate results for both balanced and imbalanced data sets. And they talk about precision. We all hear about precision, but in this particular instance, it measures how many of the positive predictions made by the model were correct. And recall measures how many of the positive class samples present in the database were correctly identified by the model. And then there's something called the concordance index, another metric to evaluate the predictions made by an algorithm, and it's commonly used in survival analysis. So the advantages of deep learning. It can be very accurate. That's still debatable in these cases that I'm going to show you. It can achieve state-of-the-art performance. So we all know about natural language processing, image recognition, facial recognition. It's quite incredible. It can automatically discover and learn relevant features from data without the need for manual feature engineering. And then you can take massive data sets. And I think that's, to me, that's one of the biggest things. Massive amounts of data can go in and it can use all of that data. It's also very flexible and it can continually improve as well. As more data becomes available, it can improve, just like the human brain. But there's a lot of challenges. It needs large amounts of data. Therefore, a lot of data needs to be annotated by people. So that can be thousands to millions of people in different data sets annotating data all over the world. You need huge amounts of computational resources. It's very time consuming initially. And then the big problem is that it's a black box. You can't actually work out how it's getting to where it's gone sometimes, very often. And you don't really know it can make it difficult to explore the biological mechanism underlying the predictive performance. And then if the model keeps getting trained again and again, it can be overfitted and it can become too specialized for that training data set. So there needs to be a lot of tweaking of the model as well. So I'm going to start with the first paper. by Lamy, sorry, not Lamy, was it Lamy? Yes, Lamy et al. Overcoming the inter-observer variability in lung adenocarcinoma subtyping. And they also use a clustering approach to establish a ground truth for downstream applications. So you'll hear the ground truth. It's not really gold standard, I guess. It's ground truth. It's better than a gold standard for downstream applications. And I think Anya was on this paper, and I think Maxwell Smith as well. So this is the flow diagram, just showing how this study was done. So they had three sets of data, and the theory behind this is that to accurately identify different lung adenocarcinoma histological subtypes, there's a lot of inter-observer variability, even amongst experts. They wanted to use cluster analysis so they could identify relevant subgroups of items through statistical analysis and divide a group of entities into more uniform and mutually exclusive groups based on their correlations. So not just from the annotation by pathologists. So they use a deep learning algorithm. And what they did, they took a set of consensus images of lung adenocarcinoma subtypes, and then these subtypes would then be classified. The algorithm would be trained. Finally, it would be clustered, and then they would have the ground truth that could be used to train, that could be used in future studies, and for public use. So it was a single institute, and they took cases from 2007 to 2020. They had three sets of image of learning groups. So WSI stands for whole slide images. So they had small patches where they take small patches of the slide. They take areas of relatively uniform histology, and they also look at the whole slide in some cases. And they had 17 expert lung pathologists and one poor pathologist in training. So I think the pathologist in training did most of the work initially. So I'm not going to go into huge details about the methodology, but so for example, the first set they talked about a dominant pattern was recorded out of 4,702 patches. So I think the junior pathologists did these first, and then the senior pathologists then sorted them separately. So everybody's score was separate. The patches of the first set were reviewed using an application for smartphones or tablets. And I wonder, is that the best way to look at images on my cell phone? I don't like to do that on my cell phone. But that's what they chose to do. In the second set, the dominant subtype of annotated areas representing relatively uniform lung adenocarcinoma histology was recorded. So it was a dominant type. And by the way, they only looked at these particular types. So lipidic, acinar, papillary, micropapillary, solid, invasive mucinous, and then everything else is classified as other carcinoma types. Invasion was defined as a lung carcinoma other than lipidic growth. And then in the third set, each subtype present in the entire slide of the 2329 slides was recorded. 15 pathologists provided a case-level diagnosis of 142 patients by determining the dominant and minor subtypes of lung adenocarcinoma for each patient and their estimated percentages in 5% increments. So that must have been a ton of work. I'm sure Anya could give us some pointers afterwards. I'm not going to go in the stats. And then in these groups, they had consensus patches and areas, and then they did cluster analysis. What's very important is I think they did take old slides and restain them and make sure they were stained properly, which is important. So this figure two shows you how each of the 18 pathologists performed, not really how they performed, but how they classified the different cancers. And you can see there's a huge variation in lipidic. Solid was actually quite solid. It was quite good. Most people got similar percentages of solid, but whether they got all the same cases of solid, this doesn't really tell you. So in the first set, 37% had an overall consensus among all pathologists. And the overall FLICE Kappa score was 0.58, which is really moderate. Solid pattern was the best, most consensus patches, followed by invasive mucinous, acinar, and micropapillary were the ones that had the most consensus. And there was no complete consensus on lipidic, papillary, and other carcinoma types, as you can see here, I think. So these are the solid was the one that had the most consensus. I'm not going to go through that, but this is just showing you the individual heat maps. Then the pathologists were hierarchically grouped into two clusters by the machine. So the majority were in this cluster, less than that one, and then outliers were on either side here. And these were called, so these pathologists were then outliers, and they were basically told, go away, we don't want you anymore. And they retained 12 pathologists for the final evaluation. And then so just to mention, in the third set, survival analysis was conducted to evaluate the ability of pathologists and clusters to separate non-invasive predominant from invasive predominant tumors. But the morphology of the tumor is not the only determinant of survival. So I think there's so many issues with doing that, clustering everything based on survival. But that's what they did. Just to show again how solid did better here, invasive mucinous was better in the third set. And what was interesting is how the consensus was actually a lot worse in the third set. So I don't really understand that. I thought the machine was learning. Anyway, we'll talk about that a little bit. I won't get into this, but these are Venn diagrams, which kind of explain a lot of complex data in visual form, which is kind of useful. So that was that paper, I think. Sorry, I just want to check that I'm not getting mixed up with the other paper. No, I'm not. I don't think so. So pairwise agreements for invasive versus non-invasive patches were 0.05 to 0.76, which is not very good. And the highest agreement among pathologists was agreements for cancer versus non-cancer. So that to me is a no-brainer. You should be able to say if it's non-cancer, but obviously not always. In conclusion, they said the marked variation in inter-observer agreement for invasive versus non-invasive patterns is worrying, as the size of the invasive component is a determinant of the T stage, which is true. They said that reasons for the relatively low agreement for differentiating cancer from non-cancerous patches was because there's macrophages or reactive epithelial cells, and fatigue due to having to sort a considerable number of patches. So here I would say, why don't we use immunohistochemistry to sort this out better? But this wasn't part of the study. So the worst agreement was acinar and papillary on the first set. And they also said that pathologists, if they were able to magnify each slide up to 20 times magnification and to view the whole slides, didn't improve in agreement, which I think might just be a reflection of the fact that they were now being asked to do a lot more on a whole slide than they were in patches. Agreements of the third set were lower than the second set. They think this is due to misclassification of cribriform or complex glandular patterns as other carcinoma, so misrecognition. There was also possible intra-observer variability because they said some pathologists then changed the way they were classifying tumors halfway through the study. And so therefore it seems like inspection of small areas with minimal morphological features at low power results in better agreements when evaluating lung adenocarcinoma subtypes. But maybe it's a case of everybody has one tiny little area to look at and everybody just comes to the same conclusion because it was that, you know, it all looks at low power, it all looks the same, maybe. I don't know. The selection of the clustering approach over the majority rule is explained by the fact that the cluster analysis creates subgroups of pathologists with distinctive diagnostic criteria for lung ADC subtypes, which can help to refine ground truth images. But it's like saying, well, one set isn't wrong, they're both right. So I don't really understand the clustering. They also said an 80% agreement rule was abandoned as it resulted in few consensus patches. So if you can't get 80% of people to agree, then you have to do something else, it sounds like. They also talked about various cases that they didn't agree on. And again, apparently they didn't agree on invasive mucinous and microbe pylori. Well, then a mucin stain might help with that. And they say that after validation with survival analysis, the whole set of ground truth images will be made publicly accessible. And then they pointed out the limitations is that there are only 49 cases from an in single institute, and therefore more infrequent adenocarcinomas such as coloid or fetal were not sufficiently represented. The annotation on the second set was done by a trainee pathologist. So that's like, why would you take the most difficult thing and give it to a trainee? To me, it doesn't make sense. We know why trainee pathologists get to do this kind of work. The agreement of the third set revealed a similar score to that obtained from the second set, so agreement was still low. The consensus patches retrieved from the two clusters were not demonstrated to improve the overall agreement. And although the clustering approach resulted in better identification of invasion than some pathologists alone, consensus patches themselves were not used to evaluate the improvement of lung adenocarcinoma subtype recognition. This issue needs to be addressed in a separate study in which consensus patches can be used to train CNN models. I wonder if the same people will be volunteering again. So, to me, the take-home message is that inter-observer agreement is even worse than I would have expected, and this limits the ability of this method to provide ground truth images in the way they're doing this for a future training set. And I doubt the validity of a lot of the data from this. And also, heavy reliance on trainee pathologists is not ideal. So, any comments from people?
I guess, did they mention grade? I mean, we have a lot of emphasis. I know the grade is kind of
Sorry, I
related.
can't hear you.
Oh,
Sorry,
sorry.
there we go. I just
Okay.
turned my volume up. Sorry.
Okay. No, did they talk at all about grade? I guess the reason I'm asking is although there is a relationship between the grade and the histologic subtype, it's still more forgiving, I think. And in the end, I think the grade is probably more predictive of. Actually, grade has always been been predictive of outcome, much more than just the individual histologic patterns, and that might be a more reasonable target. There might be more agreement there, and then maybe more ease for a computer to learn.
I think they didn't, but the next paper did. Is that do you can you recall, Agnolo? I think the next
Yeah,
paper.
no, we did not create them. We
You
did not
didn't.
create them.
I
Yeah.
think the next paper did that, yeah.
And I have to say, it's easier to look at these patches than the whole slide, because in the whole slide you have multiple different patterns and all of that, so the patches is a bit easier in
Yeah.
that regard.
Anya, isn't the grade, this is Andras, isn't the grading based on the histology, the histologic patterns?
Well, that's what was proposed by the IASLC. So you probably would have to just take the patterns, but then also look at the percentages. And I don't think we really put in the percentages of these high grade patterns.
Right. So, if no more comments, I'll go on to the next paper. So this was Ding et al. And it was kind of similar. Again, deep learning classification, but they also want to look at the spatial prognostic risk score on a whole slide images of lung adenocarcinoma. And this is the summary of the flow. Just need to move. Right, there we go. So this is overflow, the workload overflow, sorry, the workflow overview. And so they have the hypothesis that a DL model will aid pathologists in identifying and quantifying the proportion of histological subtypes, and extracting the spatial features of each one will in turn enhance the prognosis of what they call of lung adenocarcinoma patients. So they established a well-annotated data set from whole slide images containing 40,000 level pathology level tiles derived from 460 single lesion whole slide images from 129 patients. Here they only looked at five types of carcinoma patterns: lipidic, acinar, papillary, micropapillary, solid, and adenocarcinoma. What I would like to know, though, in this case, as well as in the previous study, was did they sample the whole tumor? Because if you're going to talk about percentages, you need to sample the whole tumor. And if they didn't sample the whole tumor, what percentages, et cetera. So they built and trained this deep learning model, which they called LSDLM. I'm just going to call it the deep learning model. And then this was evaluated on internal and two external testing data sets. And at the end, they did a what's called a transfer test on the Cancer Genome Atlas data set. And here they used two pathologists, one with 3 years and one with 8 years of work experience, who reviewed the H&E slides and
Yeah, I
annotated
mean,
it. Sorry? Somebody asking anything? Is everything okay? Okay. When the evaluations conflicted, another pathologist with 20 years of work experience made the call. So the what was also interesting is that they excluded cases where the predominant subtype was too ambiguous to determine. So they included the most difficult case, which is probably the ones that should be included. So using the results, just go to oh, so this is what I just wanted to show figure two. Here we have what they called acinar, solid, micropapillary, papillary, and lipidic. And just looking at the acinar, I tried to blow it up here. This actually looks cribriform to me. So right there was a problem with classification. And I also put some other images up that I think I got a bit mixed up. This might be from the first paper. Sorry, I might need to check that, but I think it just shows the problems with inter-observer variability. And what apparently here was called, sorry, this was the first paper because it was clustered. Apologies for that. I meant to put this in the first paper, but I think it's still interesting to look at. So cluster one, call this acinar, and cluster two, call this lipidic. And I think most people would agree that's acinar, that's invasive with fibrosis around it. And then they talk about here this high magnification in C of the enclosed area on A. And they're saying there's a debate as to whether this is invasive or not. And I think we'll all agree this is clearly invasive. So I think if you've got people all disagreeing, you really need to have true experts looking at this kind of thing. And not relying on people just because they have a certain amount of experience or however it was done. There's another set of images here. And here they had half of the pathologists indicated the presence of neoplastic cells, while the others said there were no neoplastic cells. So that could be cleared up probably with more expert pathologists and with and without immunohistochemistry, because it can sometimes be difficult. And here, these are examples of what they called solid or acinar. So they debated whether a solid or acinar here, which I think some of this is actually cribriform. Quite a lot of it's cribriform. Right, sorry. So to get back to this paper, so I won't go into they mentioned how several lesions were mistaken. They make the comment that the model tended to mistakenly identify lower risk subtypes as higher risk subtypes. But they said that's fine because of the poor prognosis of the high-risk subtypes. So few false positives are okay. So I'm not sure about that either. Then they also did geospatial analysis. This just shows the how accurate people were based on the different types of data sets. These are called confusion matrices. And moving on to the next one, when they looked at histologically mixed samples, so they had all these different mixed samples, they showed that the senior pathologist did a bit better than the junior, with the area under the curve, and the confusion matrix was a bit better. And I won't go into any of this. I have to say I didn't understand some of it, but I'd say that the what they did do was they looked at where the tumor was. So if lipidic was in a certain area next to papilleries, is my understanding, or next to solid, and that affected the prognosis. So the geospatial location. So they had an extra score using called KRS, where they put it in. And then they also did gene level differential analysis between the high risk and low risk patients from the TCGA data set. And they then had another score where they put in artificial intelligence scores based on the survival. And they looked at the performance. So again, the solid type had the highest score in the three data sets. Lipidic had the lowest score. And then papillary adenocarcinoma, sorry, acinocarcinoma and micropapillary were in the middle, in accordance with a risk level of five different subtypes. But in fact, MPA, micropapillary is a higher risk subtype. They also looked at the three mild, moderate, severe groups as well, which was better agreement, but I didn't really put that in here. So they thought that this showed a high level capacity to distinguish the lung adenocarcinoma subtypes. And it's quite interesting that I think the it's quite interesting when they're looking at the spatial where the different areas of tumor are, they're bringing in the tumor microenvironment, talking about immune cold regions. So down the line, I'm sure that it's probably already been done in lung cancer. I'm not sure. But looking at tumor cells and inflammatory cells and that kind of thing in the matrix with AI would be very helpful because it's one of the very difficult things to do by the naked eye. They had limited scale of data sets again, only 460 WSIs, because that's pretty small in this kind of data. So they want to do this again with larger, well-annotated data sets. They didn't include the high-grade patterns, crib reform, etc. And I think the take-home message is that DL is here to stay. We're going to have to see a lot more of these papers. Again, the black box nature makes it difficult to assess how useful each model is. And I have to say, garbage in, garbage out. If they're classifying things and they're having so much trouble telling whether it's lipidic or invasive or acinar on some of those images, it's not going to be a good outcome. And again, the use of inexpensive pathologists is not something that would be a good idea, I think, to do these very, very important work. Any comments?
Well, I was wondering, they kicked out a few cases in the beginning, right? Because they couldn't really classify them. Did they then include them in the validation set? And did they, what's the validation set able to classify these cases?
No, the validation set was really using the initial cases.
Oh, okay.
They didn't look at those again. They kind of took the easy way. I think they recognize that they've got to have some kind of gold standard in there. And there was just no, there probably was no consensus on the difficult cases, which are the exact ones that this model probably needs to look at eventually.
I see. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right, in the last 15 minutes or so, I was going to just talk about these two cases. There were two papers talking about variants of bronchiolar adenoma or not. The first case was this particular entity that these authors now want to call the peripheral type squamous cell neoplasm of uncertain malignant potential. People love the acronyms. Is it a variant of bronchial adenoma or an underrecognized entity? So what they did here was they came across this in their practice and they scratched their head and then they tried to find some more cases that looked like that. So they managed to find 10 cases that they thought were this particular entity. And they had previously been diagnosed as squamous cell carcinoma, atypical squamous cell hyperplasia, squamous papilloma, bronchial adenoma, and they now want to lump it into this particular group. So they took these 10 cases and then they wanted to compare them to classical bronchial alveolar bronchiolar adenomas. And as we know, all B, I'm going to call them BAs, have a continuous layer of basal cells and can be subtyped into proximal type or distal type. And proximal, and this does not refer to where they are in the bronchial wall, bronchial area, because they're all peripheral in the bronchial area, but they're peripheral, but it's based on the types of cells. So the proximal type has mucinous and or ciliated cells and is TTF1 negative, and the distal type doesn't have those cells, really is a positive TTF1. But I don't know why the BAs I wanted to compare it to, they compared it all with a proximal type. And I don't know why they didn't use the distal type, because this particular entity doesn't have a lot of mucinous or ciliated cells. So they had a small group, so 10 patients with a, I'm going to call it the peripheral type neoplasm. And they had 6 patients with a BA, classical BA. They're all non-smokers. They're mostly women. And the tumors all ranged in the same range, up to 3 centimeters. They were all peripheral, well-defined, solid, mixed glass, ground glass nodules, and they were stable, grew very slowly. This is the summary of the of what these tumors look like. So as you can see, there's these single layers, and then there are these squamous areas as well. And with TTF1, the basal areas and the squamous areas are positive, which is unusual for squamous cells to be positive for TTF1, and they were positive for P40. So I think this is their driving reason for making this a separate entity. And Ki67 was low. So the Ki67 index was low. There was no atypia, only mild and focal, low mitotic activity, no necrosis, and no destructive invasion, obviously, which would make you think of squamous carcinoma. Here they show you a little bit more detail. So the hyperplastic squamous cells, and they said that it kind of formed a lipidic pattern in some areas. The squamous nests sometimes discontinuously extend along the alveolar wall into air spaces, and that would be so concerning for squamous carcinoma on low power. But the squamous cells are very bland, stratified with intercellular bridges. But how do you tell the difference between well-differentiated squamous carcinoma on that field? I find that difficult. And then they have entrapped pneumocytes, which occasionally show reactive hyperplasia. And this is just another higher power, but they wanted to show here that the squamous nests are bound within the elastic fibers and not causing destructive destructive growth through the tumor. So the squamous nests are bounded within the wall and they haven't left the wall. And then just showing the immuno again, the pneumocytes are CK7 positive. The squamous cells are positive for TTF1, P40, CK56. P53 is also a wild pattern and the index was low. So based on this, they concluded that this was sufficiently different to proximal type BAs. They went through a couple of other tumors why it wasn't that. They also showed that the molecular was quite different. So BAs, as we know, are BRAF positive, they can have KRAS. In their group, they have no EGFR mutations, but they found that in their group, the most common mutation was this exon 20, EGFR exon 20 insertion. 4 out of 10 had the EGFR exon 20 insertion. However, they didn't compare this with distal type VAs, and they even mentioned in their discussion that EGFR exon 20 insertions have been described in 2 distal type VAs. So they said they couldn't compare to distal type VAs due to lack of residual sample. So that was an easy way out. They also said how this is going to be a difficult thing to exclude from peripheral squamous cell carcinomas that we're seeing more of in these days. But because peripheral squamous cell carcinomas can also display a lipidic growth pattern and present as ground glass nodules. So you have to keep this in mind, which is a good thought. And I think the take-home message, I don't think I'm convinced is a separate entity. I think the jury's still out and we need to see more of these tumors to decide that. But I think it's interesting that they point out the co-expression of TTF1 and P40, and we should watch out for these recurrent EGFR exon 20 insertions. So any comments on that? Has anyone seen these?
Julie, I think we do come across those. And it's always the case, I know that I'll share or show because I'm like, oh, am I going to call it squame? Is it because it looks so bland? And never did a K67, but at least in this study, very low K67. And on top of that, EGFR mutation. So I think a couple we pushed into bronchial adenoma, just thinking maybe the squamous component is a little more robust than what we see, because at the same time it looks so bland. So I don't know. I'm kind of curious. I'm sure others have come across that.
Yeah, it seems very similar to that large series of bronchiolar adenomas that was just published a few months ago. They described something that they called basal cell hyperplasia, which I think is exactly this. That's what they called it, you know, basically multi-layered. I'm sorry?
What do they call it? What
basal cell hyperplasia in a bronchiolar adenoma. Yeah. So, I mean, I think they're describing, I think, exactly the same thing in that paper. So they accepted that in the spectrum of bronchiolar adenoma in that paper.
Why do they call these of unknown malignant potential? Did they have any that behave badly? Like, I think it is known, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. I think they didn't have any. I think they followed them up. Maybe they just... They did follow them up. I can't recall how long they followed them up for. They only had 10. They didn't have any that recurred.
It just seems using that terminology unnecessarily sparks anxiety about something that's benign.
Yeah, I agree. I'd hate to get these at frozen, that's for sure. And I'll just go on to the other case. So this is the other paper. The bronchiolar adenoma with squamous metaplasia. So this is their little summary of what these tumors look like in a cartoon. And these are the histological features. And I can't really tell the difference between this and what we've just seen. So their aim here, they identified a BA that had undergone squamous metaplasia, and they wanted to characterize what they believe is a novel variant of BA. So they took 5 cases. One patient had 2 of these, so there were 4 patients altogether from 2012 to 2019, and they characterized them. Again, they were all female. Females are the majority in these. Mean age was 50. They were all asymptomatic. The CT scan had nothing special. They had the 2 cellular components, the bilayered bronchiolar type cells with the basal cells, and the inner stroma with sheets of spindle, oval, and polygonal cells, which represented squamous metaplasia. All 5 cases had cilia on the surface epithelium, interestingly, while mucinous cells were absent. A continuous layer of basal cells was detected subjacent to the columnar surface cells. The columnar epithelium was positive for TTF1 and napsin, negative for squamous cell markers, as expected. The stroma with a sheet-like proliferation, which was squamous metaplasia, again, no cytologic ectopia, no increased mitotic activity or necrosis, was again positive for the P40, P63, CK56, but negative for TTF1. So that's different to the other one. Again, the Ki-67 proliferation index was less than 5%. They point out that this mimics the papillary pattern of round cells seen in pulmonary sclerosing pneumocytoma, but of course, those stromal cells are TTF1 positive, which helps. But in the other case, that could be a problem in the other paper where they were positive. And the molecular, all five of them had the BRAF V600 mutation, which I think is common in BAs anyway. So they say that this is a distinctive type of BA, and I'm not convinced at all. But I think it's important to recognize this and not confuse with squamous cell carcinoma or sclerosing pneumocytoma. So any comments on that? Any comments about any of the other papers? So there was another paper that talked about outcome-supervised deep learning for survival prediction of immunotherapy, which was interesting because they looked at the H&E pattern of tumor staining and said it was better than staining with PD-L1, and then trying to estimate whether or not it was expressed in the tumor cells, which is an interesting concept, but they didn't actually... They said it was better than PD-L1, but they gave no data or information about the PD-L1 staining in that, so that we just had to rely on their comment about that. There were a few other deep learning type things. There was a summary on angiosarcomas and epithelioid hemangioendotheliomas, which are quite rare, but they're very problematic. They also had two case reports of histoplasma, which I found interesting, presenting completely differently in both patients. One is a nodule and one is disseminated histoplasmosis. They talked about histoplasmosis as being an encapsulated fungus, but it's not, so I kind of just mentioned that. Yeah, so I think we're at 8 o'clock. Any comments from anyone?
Thank you much.
All right.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Bye. Have a good day.